Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. The biggest ruckus seems to be always from the youngest of us here, but that's the way it goes. You know, youth must be served. Anyway, good afternoon again. Thank you for your prayers. We have had a very abundant rainfall here lately, and may even have some more. We hope actually for some more, but we're grateful for that. And as I said, we thank you for your prayers. Speaking of praying, a fellow walked out of a church and he was confronted by his pastor. His pastor said, "You need to join the army of the Lord." And the fellow said, "I am in the army of the Lord." And the pastor said, "Look, I only see you on Christmas and Easter." So the fellow said, "I'm in the Secret Service." I thought we might like that since the CIA has come up this week a lot. But I don't really want to deal with those issues, you know, lest I get indigestion. Anyway, good afternoon again. Speaking of indigestion, though, it is unfortunate when we do see the news, the kind of things that are going on. And, you know, history does tend to go in cycles. And right now we're in a cycle where our civilization is coarsening, getting rougher in a way. There seems to be a decline in standards. And I think most people would accept that in almost every field, even in just the use of language and grammar. And then in styles and in music and in almost every area in sports, we find just a decline and a coarsening and a hardening. And even though people are talking about peace all the time and how peaceful we are supposed to be, but yet we seem to become at the same time more and more violent. So it's like we're going to extremes. We've got the extreme doves and the extreme hawks and so on. So at a time like this, we've got to really work hard to in our own minds and hearts, maintain proper standards. The talk I'm going to give today, I'm calling Some Comments from a Biblical Outlook. I'm calling this talk Some Comments from a Biblical Outlook. When I was in the yeshiva, when I was in rabbinical training, our mentor, who we called Rebbe, our Rebbe, our Rebbe used to give us a talk on Sabbath afternoon, which we call Hashkafa, or to give us an outlook, a kind of overview of the world from a perspective of one who was quite wise and learned, who knew all of the texts, you know, the Bible, the Talmud, and he'd been to all of the top yeshivas in Europe before the Holocaust, come back to America and helped establish different schools here. He was actually one of the great figures of the 20th century, though he was extremely modest. In fact, I wondered whether anybody would ever give him any credit. And finally, I did see, ironically, is when I left the yeshiva, almost immediately after I left, somebody came who became a very eager student of his and maybe did what they would have hoped that I would have done, you know, went on to write a tribute to him in English, so that there is now a tribute available. So if you wanted to look him up, his name was Yehuda Davis, this rabbi that taught me, Yehuda Davis. And if you look him up, you'll find a very fine tribute written about him. But anyway, he would give us these talks, which we call Hashkafa, that's what we would call it in Israeli Hebrew, and we spoke a different form of Hebrew in the yeshiva. I think it's time once in a while to take a look at the world from a biblical outlook. And we have to understand the society in which we are, that you can get used to things that you really shouldn't get used to. So sometimes it's good to step back and take a look and really analyze what's going on and think, wow, what are people going to say in the future when they look back at this time and they see what entertained people and they see how people acted and they see the statistics on different things that were going on? They're going to think it's almost unbelievable. You know, when they read the history of the 20th century and what went on, the First World War, the Second World War, Cambodia, Rwanda, Stalin, Mao, you know, when they read this stuff, they're going to think, how could all these things have happened in such a scale? Or when they read about some of the activities going on in America, how many people are now listed as sexual predators, and just on and on, you know, the different kinds of heinous, bizarre crimes that go on. You know, now fortunately, a lot of people aren't doing those things, but unfortunately, far too many are. I'd like to go to the book of Romans. Romans tells us, well, it reveals to us something that some people, I think, would know if they thought about it, that human beings are born with certain natural senses because we're human. The Bible says we're made in God's image. And human beings have a sense of what is fair. I mean, what is fair and what is unfair. Because we have a sense of what is right. We have a sense of what is right and what is wrong. Now, think about it. Beauty. Think about beauty. Most people, when they get together and see something beautiful, they'll agree, isn't that beautiful? Most people, when they see a sunset or a sunrise or a mountain like Mount Fuji in Japan and so on, you know, most people would agree, isn't that beautiful? And the same thing if you hear the birds chirping, you hear the gurgling of a brook, the splash of a waterfall, the crash of a waterfall. People are impressed and they think, isn't that a beautiful sound? So there is a consensus. And speaking of beautiful sounds, this afternoon as I was getting ready to come to services, I was listening to Aquilibrium. I was listening to one of my son's CDs. And I know that some of you have enjoyed his hymns when you've listened on the Holy Days. And if any of you do want to request his music, it's available. We don't sell it. We give it away. And so if you do, if you want to request Daniel Kaplan's music, we can send you that if you want it. Unfortunately, we don't yet have a collection of his hymns. That might be a good thing to do sometime. We'll have to sort of form an ad hoc choir and then do a recording of his hymns. I'll appoint Gideon as director, you know. And we can do, well, one time we did that, we had something like that in Yuma, Arizona. I brought a bunch of college students down there for Pentecost. Pentecost is coming up. I brought a bunch of college students down there for Pentecost, and they formed the ad hoc festival choir in Yuma, Arizona, and performed some music. My children, my older children will remember that that time. Anyway, we agree generally on what is beautiful and what is in terms of sound and what we see all around the world. I know, for example, there recently was a big flap in America over Miss USA. Well, most people, when they see those women, would agree they're attractive women. You know, you wouldn't have to wonder about it. And so I'm saying there's a general consensus of who is handsome, who is beautiful. There's a general consensus on that. Now, yes, there are different standards. There are nuances. And it's the same with a conscience. People have a sense of what is fair and what is right and what is necessary to preserve society. You know, people get together and they know they shouldn't steal from each other. They shouldn't murder each other. There's got to be some kind of stability in the society. You know, there's a certain sense of right and wrong. And that's because we're created in God's image. And so we do have a conscience. And the book of Romans talks about that. Paul writes in Romans 2 and verse 14, talking about people who were not given the Torah. They've not read the Bible, you could say. But yet they have a sense of right and wrong. For when Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are law in themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves, their thoughts accusing or else excusing them, in the day when God will judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ, according to my gospel. So in the period of judgment, they're not going to be able to say, well, I didn't know any better. In some cases they might, but in basic morality, they won't be able to say that. Their own teachers have taught them, don't, you know, be faithful to your mate and don't steal and don't lie and so on. Their own teachers have also taught them those things. So there is a certain conscience. On the other hand, it should be acknowledged, and I think we understand, that people can have their conscience distorted. And that's why we have to have a Bible, you know, because we can have a distorted and cloudy view. And some areas become gray areas, and we begin to kind of get fuzzy there. And sometimes we can get so perverted that we can think we're doing good when we're doing evil. And that can happen, and societies can get that perverted. And in some very, we might call primitive societies, there are practices that are just way out of line. Like, for example, people go out and kill their enemies, shrink their heads and collect them and make decorative items out of them, or eat other people, not because out of necessity, but just because they feel like doing it. You know, that those kinds of things are wrong and perverted. Some people have become primitive and have kind of retreated to isolated areas where they could live their own kind of primitive life. In some cases, they were driven there because people didn't want to be around them and they just drove them over there. And the book of Job talks about that. Sometimes we wonder about some of these primitive peoples, how they got to where they got, the, you know, where they live. In some cases, they were driven there by others. In some cases, they may have wanted to be, you know, do their own thing and leave more civilized society, so they would have been able to get on boats and go a certain distance and survive and then be on an island and do what they wanted to do there, live the more primitive way of life. And the book of Job does talk about that. I want to go to Job 30. Job 30, because sometimes we wonder, you know, when we see these primitive peoples, how they got where they are. And as I said, Job seems to be referring to that. I'm going to Job, the 30th chapter. But now they mock at me. Job is talking about how he has come down in status, you know. But now they mock at me when men younger than I, whose fathers I disdained to put with the dogs of my flock, you know, people that he considered they were low lives, he didn't want them around. Indeed, what profit is the strength of their hands to me? Their vigor has perished. They are gaunt from want and famine, fleeing late to the wilderness, desolate and waste. So they went to areas that nobody else wanted. Who pluck mallow by the bushes and broom tree roots for their food. You know, basic things that others, you know, would not even, you know, mess with necessarily, you know, surviving as best they can, so to speak. They were driven out from among men. They shouted at them as at a thief. They had to live in the clefts of the valleys, in caves of the earth, in the rocks. Among the bushes they brayed, under the nettles they nestled. They were sons of fools, yes, sons of vile men. They were scourged from the land. And so he's talking about very primitive type people that were basically driven out of civilized society, so they made their homes in desolate regions that others didn't want to deal with, and they developed the art of survival, you could say, because they chose to a certain lifestyle others couldn't handle, and so they had to go to those areas, and then they developed, as I said, a certain ability to survive in those kinds of areas. So there are some unfortunate situations where societies become kind of frozen in a very primitive state, with practices that are, you know, highly questionable. But in general, civilization tends to go in cycles. You have periods when people are perhaps a bit stricter, a bit more serious about life and greater issues, and perhaps they're dedicated to certain causes and they sacrifice maybe some of their own indulgences for the sake of the greater cause. And you have periods when morality is perhaps a little bit, you know, a bit stronger. Then you have other periods when people tend to just focus on self-indulgence and there tends to be a breakdown of morality. And that, of course, often will lead to a disruption in the society and a collapse, and then, of course, a replacement. And so you have these cycles. And unfortunately, we're in such a cycle now, where right now, wherever you look in the world, there seems to be now great instability and great corruption, unfortunately, or fanaticism, extremism, where people are doing actions that may be very devout but very extreme, and you wonder what kind of devoutness is motivating them, if that's really what's motivating them with some of the things that they do. So I'd like to go to 2 Timothy along those lines, because Paul told Timothy that as we came to the climax of human history, that things would get really seriously bad, you know, that it would be in one of those down cycles. Christ would come to a world where things would be getting really out of hand, where we would be desperate for as the news, U.S. News and World Report magazine put it when I was a young person, a strong hand from someplace. You know, we would need something to intervene and deal with it. In 2 Timothy 3, and of course Paul studied under Gamaliel, and you can find similar references in the Talmud, in the oral tradition of the Jews. The Jews believed that the Messiah will come in two kinds of situations, one or the other. Either the world will get so good that God will send the Messiah because there's a mass repentance, or the other idea, and this is what most people think, is that the world will get so bad the Messiah will have to come. And that's the general way it's probably going to be. And that's what 2 Timothy talks about. And so Paul says, but know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. And he goes on and talks about and there's one interesting scripture I want to refer to here in verse 5. Having a form of godliness but denying its power. You know, in America particularly, where it seems to be chic to have some kind of religion and go to church, we have some of the leading proponents of immorality are clerics. Because in America, it seems that people want to be religious, they want to be good, and they want, and many people want to go to church and have that experience, maybe culturally, or maybe they want to feel good. But when they go to church, they hear really vile things from the pulpit, and their clerics encourage perverted activity in some cases. It's really sad. But that's what we have, having a form of godliness but denying its power. They really don't want the God of the Bible, you know, but they want some form of religion. And this, I think, is particularly common in America. In many other countries, people simply want to be secular, no religion. But in America, they want to, in effect, have their cake and eat it too. They want to consider themselves church members and yet endorse a morality that is certainly not a biblical morality. It's interesting and sad. But that's the world in which we live. So at a time like that, we have to be very careful to step back, evaluate, and see to it that we're not going that same direction. Because as Paul says here, when he lists all of these problems, he finally says at the end of verse 5, well, I'm in that verse anyway, so let's read the whole verse. Having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away. So Paul says, yeah, they're going to be like that. A lot of people are going to be like that, but don't you be like that. Don't you be like that. Now, sometimes it's good to step back and look and see what can happen in a society when you have this slippery slope, when things begin to get out of hand and how far out of hand they can get. And so I wanted to give an example from the time of the judges. I'd like to go back to something that happened at the time of the judges just to show you how things can get out of hand and people can get involved in things that, and yet others will look back on it and say, how could it have gotten like that? How could that have happened? How could people have gotten involved in things like that? And I want to tell you that when people look back on this period in history, they'll be making the same comments. They're going to wonder, how did it ever get like that? But anyway, let's go to the book of Judges, and let's go the first to the 17th chapter in the 6th verse. And you'll notice that at this time in history, you might say that God gave the people a long leash. They didn't have a powerful monarch with a palace, with an army, with institutions of that sort to unite the people. Rather, they had a simpler form of government. They had judges, and they were supposed to be in some way self-regulating. And of course, that system didn't work out. And even though God didn't really want them to have a king either, he wanted to be their king rather than have a human king. But when they were given this long leash, they did very poorly. In Judges 17 and verse 6, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. But if you read the book of Judges, you'll see really weird things were done. And horrific things were done, and yet people thought they were doing the right thing. That's what it had come to. So let's go to one section of Judges. Now, this is at the end of the book, but it happened early in the period, early in the history of the Judges. So presumably Joshua had already died, but they were fairly recently in the land, settling in. They had not been there for centuries, no. I said this is very early in the period of the judges, because this is still when the grandson of Aaron, Phinehas, the high priest, is still alive at this time. He was a grandson of Aaron, so he would have been quite young when they were in the wilderness, but he would have lived till they came out of the wilderness, lived until they entered the promised land, and he was still alive evidently after Joshua's death. But this was early in the time of their entry into the land, because Phinehas is still alive. Anyway, let's go to Judges 19. And it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel. See, once again, this point. And people had more, in effect, self-control, or they should have, but it, you know, it didn't work out. That there was a certain Levite staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. So he was in more of a rural setting, not in a city, but more in the back country. But he was a Levite. So every once in a while he was supposed to come and do his service in the tabernacle, and he took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. So Judah was, of course, the tribe that would eventually bring the Messiah. But Judah was one of the 12 tribes of Israel, and he was a Levite, and he went down to Bethlehem. We all heard of Bethlehem, of course, and in Judah, and he got himself a concubine there. Well, that's of course not ideal. He should have had a wife and had a normal family life, but instead he had this servant girl who became a wife, but in an inferior status. She was both a wife and a servant, a concubine, which is not obviously ideal, but that's what happened. So anyway, we to skip over some of this, you can read about how he visited with her family and so on. But finally, we're going to go around verse 10, where he and a male servant and this concubine are now heading home. This is in verse 10. However, the man was not willing to spend that night. He didn't want to stay any longer where he was visiting. So he rose and departed and came opposite Jebus. Now, Jebus was a Canaanite city, which eventually became known as Jerusalem and had been known as Salem in ancient times, but it was a Jebusite city, and they were the dominant people there. Later on, as you know, David conquered it. In fact, I think I even covered that last week, how David conquered Jebus and it became his capital. But this was in the days when the Canaanites were still dominant there in Jebus. Now, it could be after they were displaced and came back, or even before they were initially displaced. I'd have to check the chronology there. But at least at this time, it was dominated by Canaanites. So this person didn't want to go there. He's an Israelite, didn't want to go to this area which was dominated by Canaanites. Jebus, that is Jerusalem. With him were the two saddled donkeys. His concubine also was with him. They were near Jebus, and the day was far spent. And the servant said to his master, "Come, please, and let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and lodge in it." Well, he was a little bit reluctant to lodge in this city. Perhaps he was concerned with his safety. But his master said to him, "We will not turn aside here into a city of foreigners who are not of the children of Israel. We will go on to Gibeah." So he wanted to go to a city where he could be with his own kind, which would, you know, seem to be reasonable. But you see, it wasn't reasonable. His own kind turned out to be, you know, as worse than these Canaanites. It's incredible. So he said to his servant, "Come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night in Gibeah or in Ramah." Now that was territory of the tribe of Benjamin, one of the Israelite tribes, north of Judah. He was leaving Judah, remember, and he was now coming into the territory of Benjamin. Now, in my opinion, Benjamin was the ancestor of the people that we know as Vikings today, so they could be rough at times. And this was not only being rough, but also being perverted, if we continue to read the account. "And they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. They turned aside there to go in to lodge in Gibeah. And when he went in, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night." It's very similar. The account seems to parallel the account of the angels who visited Lot. But the sad story is that these were not Sodomites. These were Benjamites doing the same as what the Sodomites did. That shows how Israel had declined. You go to Genesis 19 and you read that account. You're not reading about the people of Abraham and Lot. You're reading about the people of Sodom. But here you're reading about Benjamites. Benjamin, the son of Rachel and his descendants. "Just then an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who was also from the mountains of Ephraim. He was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. And when he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, 'Where are you going, and where do you come from?'" Verse 18. "So he said to him, 'We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah toward the remote mountains in Ephraim. I am from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I am going to the house of the Eternal.'" Oh, remember, he was a Levite. So he was heading eventually to go to Shiloh and serve in the tabernacle. "But there is no one who will take me into his house." So already this is a problem. He didn't want to go to the Gentiles. He went to the Israelites and nobody wanted to take him in. What kind of hospitality is that? Now, it's bad enough to not be that way. But in the Middle East, that is really bad. Of all the regions in the world, one area where hospitality is really valued is the Semitic regions. You know, the area, among Arabs and Jews to this very day, hospitality is a very powerful factor. And to imagine that Benjamites would not take him in, that's really pathetic. "Although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant, and for the young man who is with your servant, and there is no lack of anything." It's not like I'm going to sponge off of these people. I just want a place to stay. And the old man said, "Peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Only do not spend the night in the open square." So finally, here's somebody, you know, like Lot back then, and ancient, even before. Remember how Lot said, "Please, don't stay out tonight. Come on in to the angels." And so he did the same. You may remember how the book of Hebrews talks about being hospitable because you might entertain, some have entertained angels unawares. That's what happened with Lot. Anyway, these people were far from angels, but they needed a place to stay. Anyway, so he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. So you see that this account does seem to parallel the account in Genesis. Again, in Genesis also talked about washing your feet. That was an act of great hospitality in those days. And it ties in with this season of the year. We have just recently had our annual foot washing ceremony. It's one reason I'm reading the book of Judges, because I feel it ties in with this season of the year. All right, now here we go. And as they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men. Now, I believe the Hebrew term is sons of Belial. And, you know, there are various ways of understanding that, but just to get the point across in a crass way, they were what you call a biblical SOB, a son of Belial. And that's, that, to get it, a very crass way of getting it across. They were perverted men. Surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came to your house, and that we may know him carnally." He had a concubine with him, but it seemed like they weren't interested in the concubine. They were interested in the guy. It's incredible. But this man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing the man has, this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage." You know, this is very much like the story of Lot. This story is not anywhere near as well known, I believe, as Genesis 19. But it's a parallel kind of story. But the difference is that these are Israelite men doing this, who should know better, of course. And this is not long after they had just entered the land. And they had, of course, gone through all that history before that you can read about in the Pentateuch and Joshua. "Look, now look at what he says. Here is my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now. Humble them and do with them as you please, but to this vile man do not do such a vile thing." Well, that's hardly the solution. But he offers them two women. But the men would not heed him. So the man took his concubine and brought her out to them. So that was, he thought, maybe if I put her out there. And sure enough, they gang-raped her. And they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. Just a horrible account. But as horrible as this account is, these kinds of things have happened, unfortunately, too often in the last century or so. These kinds of things. Verse 26, "Then the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was till it was light." So she collapsed in front of the house, and she collapsed and died was really what happened. She collapsed and died, but he wasn't quite aware of that. He just saw her there collapsed, didn't know that she was dead initially. Now notice his reaction. This is really incredible. I mean, after all, I know she was a servant, but she was also, in effect, a wife. She was a concubine, so she was... a wife of sorts. "When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go his way, there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, 'Get up, let us be going.'" Kind of, what does that show about him and his view of her? Incredible. "But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place." So obviously she was dead. But even though he had taken her out to them, I guess he didn't realize how bad it was going to get. He was shocked at what had happened, that it had gone to this extent. You know, he would have thought maybe it'll do, you know, a few of them exploit her sexually, but he didn't know it would just go on and on until she would be killed. So he is, even though he was in effect a participant, he was shocked at the final result. And what's interesting is that the whole nation was shocked. So that does show you that this kind of thing was at that point at least shocking. At least give him credit for that. Well, let's continue on. "When he entered his house, he took a knife laid hold of his concubine and divided her into 12 pieces. Again, that's not, what you know, that's a kind of a bizarre thing to do, too. But that's one, I mean, that was before, you know, the nightly news and magazines and internet and whatever. So this is a way to get the point across. But still, he cut her in pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. So it was that all who saw it, and evidently he sent a message along with it, said, no such deed has been done or seen from the day when the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up. So this was obviously a shocking thing. Now it's interesting that, you know, what about his part in it, that he sent her out there? But I guess he could say, well, I have no idea it would get that bad. I sent her out there, but look what they did. This is way beyond what I thought. You know. So anyway, he evidently wasn't convicted of anything by them. They instead went after the Benjamites who had abused her and killed her. So anyway, now in chapter 20. So all the children of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba. So this was a major scandal, and of course it should have been. And so the various tribes came together, as well as from the land of Gilead, so from the eastern area, and the congregation gathered together as one man before the Eternal at Mizpah, and the leaders of all the people, all the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 foot soldiers who drew the sword. Now the children of Benjamin heard that the children of Israel had gone up to Mizpah. Then the children of Israel said, tell us, how did this wicked deed happen? Now, obviously, Benjamin was going to be highly outnumbered. If all the tribes of Israel were gathering together just to get Benjamin, Benjamin would be highly outnumbered. But to their advantage was they were good soldiers, and a lot of them were left-handed, which evidently was an advantage. I guess some of them were ambidextrous, where they could use both the left and the right hand. So the Levite, the husband of the woman who was murdered, answered and said, my concubine and I went into Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin, to spend the night. And the men of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me. Well, maybe they would have had he not sent this girl out to them. And they intended to kill me, but instead they ravished my concubine so that she died. So I took hold of my concubine, cut her in pieces, and sent throughout all the territory of the inheritance of Israel, because they committed lewdness and outrage in Israel. Look, all of you are children of Israel. Give your advice and counsel here and now. So all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. We will take 10 men out of every 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, 100 out of every 1,000, and 1,000 out of every 10,000, to make provisions for the people, that when they come to Gibeah and Benjamin, they may repay all the vileness that they have done to Israel. So obviously what they wanted done was that these people would be surrendered, those who did the crime, for punishment. Now it's interesting how Benjamin reacted. They should have said, well, yeah, this is horrible. We're as scandalized as you are. We don't want our tribe to be involved in a thing like this, and we'll give you up these men. Just make sure that they're tried fairly. But but that's not what they did. They all got together, circled the wagons, and they defended Gibeah. The other Benjamites decided to instead of wanting to rid their place of their tribe of this heinous crime, you know, of they actually gathered together and supported the criminals. Anyway, I'm reading on. So all the men of Israel were gathered against the city, united together as one man. Then the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what is this wickedness that has occurred among you? Now therefore, deliver up the men, the perverted men who are in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. But the children of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. Instead, the children of Benjamin gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle, against the children of Israel. And from their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men. Among all the people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. So they felt like that they were good enough soldiers, they perhaps could fight against the whole the other 11 tribes. And in some ways it's similar to the American Civil War. The North had a great population advantage over the South, but the South thought they were better soldiers and could defeat the North. And for a while, they were doing fairly well, particularly in the East, if you know the history of the Civil War. Now, besides Benjamin, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All of these were men of war. Then the children of Israel rose and went up to the house of God to inquire of God. They said, "Which of you of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin?" The Eternal said, "Judah first." Judah was supposed to be the leading, you know, in some ways the leaders, so they were to lead this attack. But the men of Israel were not really in a right frame of mind. They were thinking about vengeance and conquering Benjamin, but they really had not yet gotten into a proper attitude themselves. And God allowed them to suffer defeat initially. And then maybe it gave Benjamin a chance to reevaluate what they were doing and eventually to give up these men. So initially, Benjamin won a couple of the early engagements. And as I said, it's similar in a way to the American Civil War, where, you know, it reminds me of a incident I saw in a TV program where there was a man in court, and they said to him, I guess he wasn't in court, he was in a situation where he was being questioned by officers, and they said to him, "Were you at the Battle of Bull Run?" And he said, "Yes." "What did you do there?" "I ran." Yeah, those who didn't are still there, you know. But so in the beginning, the South had a few victories against the North as well. They shouldn't have had, but they were, you know, they had good military leadership, as you know, and they were good soldiers. And initially, the North suffered some defeats, even though they shouldn't have. And that's the situation here. Benjamin won a couple of the early engagements. And evidently, God was punishing the northern tribes, the other tribes rather, so that they could get into a right attitude, and also giving Benjamin maybe a chance to still do the right thing. Well, that didn't happen. So finally, the other tribes got into a better frame of mind. Let's go to verse 26. I'm going to go now to, if we're still together here, I'm in Judges 20 and verse 26. I hope you didn't lose me there. I started in the 19th chapter, then I went into the 20th chapter, and I'm in verse 26 of Judges. "Then all the children of Israel, that is all the people, went up and came to the house of God and wept. They sat there before the Eternal and fasted that day until evening, and they offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Eternal. So the children of Israel inquired of the Eternal, of the Ark of the Covenant of God was there, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days." I'm in verse 27. "So the children of Israel inquired of the Eternal, the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days, and Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days." So you see, it was fairly early into the period when they settled the land. So that shows you how soon conditions can deteriorate. You know, right after great people die, and other people take over, and things change. And frankly, I was in a situation like that in my own lifetime. I saw how a whole vast community changed because of the type of government structure that was there, where pretty much it was very authoritarian and top down and so on. And so a change in leadership at the top, and a vast change occurred in the whole community in a very short time. And this happened here in ancient Israel in that way, not because so much top down. The leadership was there as a great example. And once they died, people left to their own devices, went and did the kind of things you're reading about here, that I'm reading to you, and hopefully you're reading along. Anyway, let's go back to verse 28. "And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, stood before it in those days, saying, 'Shall I yet again go out to battle against the children of my brother Benjamin, or shall I cease?'" Because it was a traumatic thing. This was a civil war. This was brother against brother. But yet, nevertheless, there had been an outrage committed. "And the Eternal said, 'Go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand.'" So God did intend for Benjamin to be punished, and allowed Israel to do it in this way. "Then Israel set men in ambush all around Gibeah. And the children of Israel went up against the children of Benjamin on the third day and put themselves in battle array against Gibeah, as at the other times. So the children of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city." This is a similar strategy to Joshua against the city of Ai. They drew the soldiers out of the base, and then they attacked the base, you know, and they were using better strategy now. So they finally had, you might say, better generalship than before. Once again, it kind of parallels the Civil War, where finally Lincoln found Grant and gave him the generalship in the East, and there was victory. "So the children of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn from the city. They They began to strike down and kill some of the people, as at other times in the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah, and in the field about 30 men of Israel. And the children of Benjamin said, they are defeated before us as at first, but no, not this time. But the children of Israel said, let us flee and draw them away from the city to the highways. So all the men of Israel rose from their place and put themselves in battle array at Baal Tamar. Then Israel's men in ambush burst forth from their position in the plain of Geba. And 10,000 select men from all Israel came against Gibeah, and the battle was fierce. But the Benjamites did not know that disaster was upon them. The Eternal defeated Benjamin before Israel, and the children of Israel destroyed that day 25,100 Benjamites. All these drew the sword. But the problem is that it went well beyond that. There was a mass slaughter of the Benjamites, evidently even women and children, and they went way beyond what they should have done. And, you know, that was their mentality, unfortunately. God had not commanded them to do that. But so evidently there was just a mass slaughter of Benjamin, where the tribe was in danger of extinction. One of the 12 tribes of Israel, of whom Jacob had prophesied, In Genesis 49, of whom Moses had prophesied in Deuteronomy 33. They were in danger now of extinction. So you see, you go from one pendulum to the other when you lose that balance, when you're not grounded in the written law, you know. So the children of Benjamin saw that they were defeated. The men of Israel had given ground to the Benjamites because they relied on the men in ambush whom they had set against Gibeah. And the men in ambush quickly rushed upon Gibeah. The men in ambush spread out and struck the whole city with the edge of the sword. I'm going to jump again a little ahead. And let's go to till chapter 21, all right? I don't necessarily need to give you the details of the battle. I wanted to give you some, kind of get us into the situation a little bit. But you can read the entire account of the battle. It's written in such a way as to show that this is a historical account. The person who wrote it was well aware of the details, and you could check the geography of the area and the strategy and what, you know, and what was going on. You could read about it. It's there as a historical account. And then we go to chapter 21, and I'm summarizing what happened. There was a mass slaughter of Benjamites, where there was only a small number of them left. And so the tribe was in danger of extinction. And obviously, you know, it was God's intent to allow a punishment, but not to go that to that degree. So now here we are in chapter 21, and now the Israelites realize, you know, we've carried this way too far. Now what are we going to do? But it gets complicated, as we'll see. Now the men of Israel had sworn an oath at Mizpah, saying, none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin as a wife. Well, they didn't need to do that. I mean, not everybody in Benjamin was guilty of the crime. It's true that the people of Benjamin had come together and said, we're going to defend our these people and not turn them over to you. But there wasn't a reason to make this kind of a vow that none of us will ever give his daughter to a Benjamite male from here on out. That was something they just decided to do in kind of a fit of anger. Then the people came to the house of God and remained there before God till evening. They lifted up their voices and wept bitterly and said, O eternal God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel that there should be one tribe missing in Israel? Well, the answer was because of the environment of the moral environment of that time, because it had gotten to the point where it had deteriorated to that degree that people in Benjamin had gotten that bad, and nothing had been done about it until this outrage had occurred. You know, that action should have been taken well before then. Anyway, so it was the next evening that the people rose early and built an altar there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. The children of Israel said, who is there among all the tribes of Israel who did not come up with the assembly of the Eternal? For they had made a great oath concerning anyone who had not come up to the Eternal at Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. So here they go again. You see, people can get this way in the middle of a war, you know, and even people can get this way. And look, I remember when I was a child. This is a personal story, but maybe it'll bring this out. Maybe you can come up with your own situations. There was a bully in the neighborhood who was a pain in the neck for everybody, and we were just little children, and unfortunately I don't know if we were being supervised as well as we should have been, but I don't want to get into that. I'll take responsibility, although I was a child. And so what we did was we took an oath on the Bible. You know, I will not play with this bully for a year. Well, you know, we had over that you know, I mean, we were just children. We shouldn't have done that kind of thing. You know, but you know, it was an overreaction. Now, our parents would have had the authority to override that if they'd known about it. You know, biblically speaking, they could have overridden it. They could have said, well, we as their parents nullify it. These, you know, their children were responsible for them and so on. But now, maybe you've done that kind of thing yourself. Maybe you've said, I will not, I don't know, eat this food or drink this thing or go to that place or read a book by this guy or whatever you may have sworn that you would do or not do, you know. So anyway, they made this oath and but not only that, but they said that anybody who doesn't participate, we're going to kill them too. That's terrible. It's bad enough you have to kill Benjamites. You want to kill other people just because they don't participate? You know. So anyway, and the children of Israel grieved for Benjamin, their brother, and said, "One tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who remain, seeing we have sworn by the Eternal that we will not give them our daughters as wives?" And they said, "What one is there from the tribes of Israel who did not come up to Mizpah to the Eternal?" And in fact, no one had come from the camp from Jabesh-Gilead to the assembly. So here was an eastern branch of Manasseh that hadn't participated in this. "For when the people were counted, indeed, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead was there. So the congregation sent out from there 12,000 of their most valiant men." I'm in verse 10 of chapter 21. "And commanded them, saying, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead with the edge of the sword, including the women and children. This is the thing that you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every male and every woman who has known a man intimately." So in other words, save the virgins. That way we can maybe have them marry these Benjamites because they're not under the vow. Now you see what's going on here? You go from one extreme to the other. It reminds me of the Talmudic statement, mitzvah goreret mitzvah. A good deed begets another good deed. Avera goreret avera. A sin begets another sin. So here they're going to wipe out everybody in that village, but save the virgins for the Benjamite men, so that tribe can survive. Anyway, so they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan, because they were not part of the vow. So they could legitimately be, you know, married to Benjamites, and the vow wouldn't be violated. "Then the whole congregation sent word to the children of Benjamin, who were at the rock of Rimmon, and announced peace to them. So Benjamin came back at that time, and they gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh-Gilead, and yet they had not found enough for them." Oh, there's still a problem. All right, 400 men now have wives, but that's not really enough. You need to have more. A lot of men are still going to go without wives. "And the people grieved for Benjamin because the Eternal had made a void in the tribes of Israel." Well, now, it's interesting to blame God for that. You know, they're the ones that just massacred everybody in sight. "Then the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for wives for those who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed?" So they came up with the concept, if you've ever seen the movie Seven Wives for Seven Brothers, if you've ever seen that movie, these people, there was some man read some book of classics and saw the story of the rape of the Sabine women, and somehow he decided that, you know, in the movie they would go and grab a bunch of women and bring them up to the mountains. If you didn't see that movie, that's fine, but I'm just saying, a lot of you have, and you know the story of the rape of the Sabine women. In fact, instead of being a negative thing, that's become the reason why American men, and I guess European men, are supposed to carry their wives across the threshold when they marry. That's based upon the incident of the rape of the Sabine women, as far as I know. Since these women were carried off, now we quote-unquote honor that. I don't even remember the episode, why it happened or how it happened. It's been so long, I don't even remember. But evidently that's why men carry their wives over the threshold initially when, you know, when they're first married. Anyway, you can study into that. If I'm wrong, you can correct me next week. Anyway, verse 17, "And they said, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel." Well, that's certainly certainly commendable. I may have skipped a verse. I want to go back to verse 14, to verse 16. "Then the elders of the congregation said, what shall we do for wives for those who remain, since the women of Benjamin have been destroyed? And they said, There must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe may not be destroyed from Israel. Now, incidentally, it's interesting the way it worked out, that the tribe that didn't come were Manassites. And, you know, Benjamin was a descendant of Rachel. And the most compatible tribe for Benjamin would have been Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim, because they're also descendants of Rachel. And evidently, the first 400 women they gave them were Manassite women. So they were also descendants of Rachel. So in that sense, the gene pool, you know, is pretty much maintained, if you follow what I'm saying. Because if you want to look at the tribes as various types of people and various gene pools, the available gene pool from Joseph was used to build up the Benjamite tribe, and they were both descendants of Rachel. So if you look at it from that point of view, it's kind of interesting. Anyway, I'm going to keep reading. However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath, saying, "Cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin." Then they said, "In fact, there's a yearly feast of the Eternal in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem, the south of Labona." So here is Shiloh, you know, which was a center of worship of the true God, and there was a festival going on there. Now, I don't know if it was a festival that God had commanded in Leviticus 23 or just some local festival. It's ambiguous here what the festival was, but there was a festival going on, and evidently as part of the festival, women would gather in the vineyards, so at least we would know that the vineyards were ripe at that time, so it might have been, presumably it might have been late summer. It might have been there is a Jewish custom to celebrate mid-August, the beginning of the grape harvest, so that might have been what it was. But anyway, the women would go and dance in the vineyards in a worshipful way. And so the idea was, well, the Benjamite men can kind of hide out and grab these women, and therefore we haven't given them the women. They've taken the women, you know, so we haven't violated the oath. You know, so technicalities, you know. So anyway, in verse 20, "Therefore they instructed the children of Benjamin, saying, 'Go lie in wait in the vineyard.'" So they even told them to do it. "And watch, and just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances, then come out from the vineyards, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh, then go in the land of, to the land of Benjamin." So, you know, what a bizarre. See, the whole thing, you know, from the time, beginning to end, hasn't the story been bizarre? But yet that's the kind of, you know, unfortunately, the kind of news we hear often now is of a similar type. Anyway, "and watch, and just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances and come out from the vineyards, and every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh, then go in the land of Benjamin." So, again, to talk about breeding here, if you want to look at it as a livestock breeder, and you're kind of working on the gene pool, you want the tribe of Benjamin to be pretty much like it used to be. Follow what I'm saying? You want to preserve the identity of Benjamin. So in this case, the Shiloh is in the territory of Ephraim. So even though this was a holiday that maybe a lot of people would have come to participate in, chances are the dominant ones there, the largest number would have been Ephraim, and maybe the second largest number Manasseh. So most of these women were descendants of Joseph, whom they grabbed. So once again, they were grabbing women who were ethnically similar. See what I'm saying? So in that sense, the gene pool is maintained. So Benjamites come out like as they were before, and the tribe is maintained in that sense. That's just a side comment, but maybe not a side comment, just part of how the whole thing went. Anyway, "then it shall be, when their fathers or their brothers come to us to complain, that we will say to them, 'Be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war. For it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath.'" In other words, they're going to come and complain to us, "We don't want our women marrying Benjamites." And we'll say, "Well, after all, this is, you know, they need women, and we don't have enough, and they took them, you didn't give it to them, so you're exempt. It wasn't your fault." And so that's how we're going to handle it. So evidently the parents of these women didn't even know about it, so that's why I'm thinking it was a localized festival, and it was local women from that area that were doing it, and the local parents who didn't even know about the plan. All of a sudden their daughters had been taken, and by these Benjamites, and they're all upset about it, and they're told, look, this is the best way to handle it. We want the tribe to survive. Anyway, verse 23. And the children of Benjamin did so. They took enough wives for their number from those who danced, whom they caught. Then they went and returned to their inheritance, and they rebuilt the cities and dwelt in them. So Benjamin began with a small number, but over time they did become, again, a constituency, a tribe of Israel. Over time they multiplied and became one of the 12 tribes. They did survive. Verse 24. So the children of Israel departed from there at that time, every man to his tribe and family. They went out from there, every man to his inheritance. That closes that chapter, a very sad chapter, but at least it closes peacefully. And with Benjamin surviving, and with the tribes returning to their land, and peace restored. But what a horrific story! And so they conclude by telling us this: in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. You know, so this is the kind of thing that can happen when things get out of hand. You know, when there's not a proper balance, not a proper respect for the law. You know, things can go to this degree. Now we are in such a culture now where we are. If you were looking at history as what peaks and troughs, we're in kind of a trough period. Now there's been worse, but we are in a period where of a coarsening of the culture and a weakening of standards, and therefore we have a responsibility who know better to maintain the standards and to set a right example. And we can at least be an island of sanity in our own families, in our own households, in the space that we occupy. We talk about it in Jewish culture as our own dalet amot, our own 4 cubits, our own 6 feet of space, you know. And at least our own little corner of the world, we can do the best we can and set a right example. I want to finish by going to Revelation 3. At a time like this, in a time of the coarsening of the culture, And a weakening of standards, we need to look at Revelation 3. And I know my family is very aware that I often quote this verse. I'm in Revelation 3 and verse 20. This is Jesus Christ speaking. I mean, you're hearing my voice, but I'm quoting him. All right. There was a time when I actually played the part of Jesus Christ. Not me, just the voice. Anyway. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him, and he with me. So regardless of what's going on around us, you know, we can have Christ's presence with us. When you walk into our household, you can see that this is a Christian household. When you're among us, you can see that you're among Christians. Even if the world as a whole is maybe not marching to a different drummer, at least when you're in our presence, you'll notice a difference. And this is what I hope is going to be the case for us and for those who are listening to me, that when people are among us, they'll see that they are in what they would identify as a Christian environment. And that we have, in fact, that we are, in fact, striving to overcome the general cultural trends that are negative. To him who overcomes, and I don't mean everything is negative, and when there is positive, you know, we can be happy for it and appreciate it, and we can in that sense reinforce it and be grateful for it when it's there. Verse 21, to him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. So the reward is great for those who go against the grain, for the fish who swims upstream and doesn't float downstream like a dead fish, but floats up, you know, swims upstream. You know, those who do that, those who do overcome, the reward is extremely great, the greatest reward that can be imagined. So as we look out at the society today, let's certainly look at the society and evaluate our own conduct, our own word, thought, and deed with a biblical outlook. Well, thanks for listening. You see there's reaction here from the crowd. So thank you. I hope there's some positive reaction out there. Those who hear it now or who have heard it now or those who will hear it later. We hope that you'll enjoy the rest of the Sabbath, or if you're listening on another day, that this day will go well for you. All the best to you and yours.